Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, Kanye, buddy, it's time to wake up.
I don't wanna.
Yeah, you know what they say, man. Another day, another dollar.
It's another day, another Donda. Just let me yawn real quick.
Where's that music coming from?
Everywhere and nowhere. Donda's a social experiment.
Well, the second your feet hit the floor, we gotta get to work.
They're not gonna.
Come on. Holy shit, are you levitating?
I never stop working. Donda dropping when I drop. I am Donda.
Is there no gravity in this room?
We're outside the realm of reality. This is the intro to a podcast.
It's all just a podcast intro. What's going on?
Life's a wreck.
Life's a wreck.
Ladies and gentlemen, individuals and people, humans and aliens alike, welcome to the greatest show on Earth. Or like the northern part of Earth, specifically Eastern Canada, New Brunswick, small. Listen, the show's not that. It's okay.
Man, just do the thing.
Sorry, yes. You've been with us for over 2 years, 60 episodes, and today we wrap up season 4. Now introducing your host. He says he's made a living off of being the dumbest guy in the room. People describe him as being the dumbest guy in the room. Your mom's favorite podcaster, Kyle Moore! And next, he makes grown men cry. Literally, he made the other guy cry a lot. Like a lot. He's the best thing to ever happen to the show. Also, Kyle Moore. But like the head voice, personification, mental health, guy thing.
Hello, podcast world.
just an honor.
What's going on, buddy?
Truly.
And count me out. 1, 2, 3, boom.
That's an entrance, baby.
I don't care, dude. I do not care what people say. We do it right.
We really do.
There's no mental health podcast with this pizzazz, this flair. You know, a little.
I'd say
a little something extra.
I mean, life's a wreck, but our production.
I mean,
come on, top notch.
Yeah. Needless to say, welcome to the season 4 finale of Life's a Wreck, guys. 60th episode of the show, still going strong.
Stronger than ever, some might say.
Couldn't agree more. And like, it's amazing just to continue to do what we love and see this community continue to flourish.
Honestly, we can't thank you guys enough for supporting us, supporting each other, buying into this idea of consuming content that is created to help inspire those listening to focus on their mental health. Brilliant.
Like, in preparation for this episode, I went back and I listened to some of the old podcasts, and it was really, really cool to see how far I've come personally, but also like the show.
Hell, dude, when this thing started, you could barely hear me.
Yeah, you also weren't really the nicest either at the time. Like, that was kind of...
And now here we are.
Here we are, a couple of good-looking besties.
Good acquaintances were... I'll draw that line.
I'll take that. Honestly, it's just like one of those... It's such an important conversation with you guys on this special day for us.
Before we get into it, though, sorry to cut you off. Housekeeping for our season finale. our boy Alistair Nicholson came up with the inspiration for this week's intro. It
had to do Donda.
Of course, obviously. And here's the sweet part. We were like, hey, man, do you want us to shout out your new
which
song?
Which is called Kevin Durant by Alan Favors on Spotify and Apple Music, just by the way. You know, just in case you're like, oh, God, I need some music to listen to.
And he goes,
like,
no, that's okay. Shout out your designers. They've been amazing lately.
What a nice guy.
So, yeah, shout out to our amazing design team, Yvette Sin and Avery Woods. That's at YVE.Sin and at AVEERY Woods on Instagram.
We're very fortunate to have, you've seen, you guys have seen the Instagram. Hopefully you guys have seen the Instagram. It's incredible. And that's, you know, I would 100% put us against any other podcast in the world about having some of the best visuals in podcasting. And it's because of them. So give them a follow and check out their work.
Also got to thank, one of the partners on this episode, Tether.
Tether is just this amazing social network that we are a part of and that you guys have heard us talk about before that helps connect men who are struggling with other men who just get it. It's a non-judgmental space to talk and connect, and we're so happy to be working with them continuously. So either tell the men in your life about it or take your little cute self over to Google Play or the App Store today. Start connecting. There's literally no downside. What's the worst that happens? You get some things off your chest, have a little bit of fun.
Is there anything else we got to check off the list before we get into it?
I don't know. Yes, we're dropping some Better Tomorrow, some new Better Tomorrow merch coming up here soon. We're gonna kind of call it a back to school capsule. So it includes two different posters designed by the incredible designers we were just talking about. Sticker packs.
Yeah, spice up your laptop, water bottle. Who doesn't love fucking stickers, dude?
Exactly. And dad hats, because everyone needs a Better Tomorrow dad hat.
Since we're transitioning between seasons, there we go. Maybe it's a good time for a break. Follow us on Instagram at Morzy, that's Morzy with three Y's, and at Life's Rec Podcast for those updates. And we'll be launching the Better Tomorrow social soon, so keep an eye out for that.
The funny thing is, and I got to give kudos to everybody listening to this who has done it, but we haven't launched our Instagram feed or Twitter feed for Better Tomorrow yet. But some of you guys have already found the Instagram account. So that's love right there, you know?
Absolutely.
Throughout the past few years, not only have we been really lucky to have you guys become part of our community and the LifeStrike family, but we've also been really lucky with the people that we've talked to. We've been able to curate and share the stories of people with all different backgrounds and sexualities, ethnicities, nationalities. And today, I think it's fitting that we continue to do that as we go into our fifth season, as we finish up our fourth season, and amplify the stories of our Indigenous neighbors. As of recording this episode, and this was a statistic I was shocked by, over 1,400 bodies of Indigenous youth have been found at residential school sites across Canada, and that number continues to rise all the time. The last residential school closed in 1996.
Just for those of you keeping track at home, that's 2 years before we were born.
So this isn't a lot of us would like to turn a blind eye to history sometimes, but this isn't even history. This is barely a generation ago. You know, our Indigenous population has had to endure constant cruelty through human history, forced from their land, families ripped apart, and like you'll hear in this episode, time and time again, through systematic oppression, having their identity stripped away. If that doesn't just scream mental health to you, I don't know what will.
Sharing these stories is so important. And I'm telling you, just to sit back and listen and learn from our guest today was awesome. Yeah. It was enlightening.
I think that's a good way to put it. For our season finale, I am so honored to welcome Cheyenne Joseph to the podcast. Cheyenne is a registered nurse with a master's degree in public health and is a certified community health nurse. She has been working in healthcare for 18 years, having worked in many sectors such as health centers, government, not-for-profit, and academia. She is currently the executive director for the Rising Sun Treatment Center in Eel Ground First Nations, New Brunswick. Cheyenne, thank you for taking the time today. How you doing?
Yeah, so check-in. So the check-in for me is that I'm as good as can be expected, I guess, given all of the challenges that we've had over the past year. And I I guess that's all I would say is things are good and we just manage mostly just day by day, especially when different rules and COVID restrictions are lifted or imposed, and just you got to be flexible and adaptable. And as someone who's grown up in an army family, we've always, I've always had to be adaptable. Who knows when my dad's going to come home and say, okay, we're moving to a new city, or, you know, I've got to go away several months on training, or it just, you got to expect curveballs in life. It's just the way it goes. So, yeah, this is just another one of those life curveballs. So you got to roll with it and be flexible. And, you know, I used to teach nursing at UNB, and it was community nursing. And I always used to tell the students, your plan A sounds really wonderful, but always have a plan B and a plan C, because there's going to be things that you don't expect to come up. But the more you have other plans to work around any potential obstacles, the smoother the process will be, and you'll get less frustrated with it. So this 100%. Is one of those examples. Yeah,
for sure. No, and I think it's funny because, like, obviously this year, or I mean these past 2 years really, like, I couldn't have imagined when COVID first started, I was still in Toronto. I was finishing up my degree at Ryerson. And I just remember, like, hopping on a call with my parents and saying, yeah, no, you know, I'm just going to kind of wait it out. They're only saying it'll be 2-3 weeks and then everything will be back under control. And now here we are 2 years later. Yeah. I'm living with my parents, moved back to the East Coast. And it seemed like everything just kind of upended within the course of, like, of 7 or 8 days, which is just crazy to think about. How is, and COVID affected everything that you're doing with the clinic? Like, how has that kind of all looked?
Yeah, so I'm the executive director of an alcohol and drug rehab center in a First Nation community in New Brunswick. And so it has completely changed everything that we do and how we do it. So, for example, when the pandemic first was declared, and in New Brunswick, the mandatory orders came into play for the state of emergency. And knowing that we're in a First Nation community, there was no other decision other than we have to close for the safety of staff and for the safety of clients and for the community. So we closed the center to everybody, and we just sort of worked from home. I mean, we've never worked from home at a rehab center before. So there was lots of question marks about what does that mean? And then we reopened in May to just staff so that we could start to come together as a team. I had just started my job that March, and they didn't know who I was. So we were still trying to figure out who I was and how I was going to relate and mix in with the team. And then how are we going to shift our program and services so that we can still, because we still need to offer addiction services at a time like this when people are super stressed out. And if their coping mechanism is to lean on drugs and or alcohol, then they're going to need us more than ever. Because I don't know if you remember, Kyle, but in the beginning, when everything closed except grocery stores and NB Liquor and cannabis stores. So we know that those, and for good reason, right? Because if people don't have access to those things, then it puts them at more risk for other health issues that are going to happen and social issues that happen. So I understand why they did that, but it just meant that people, if they needed to lean on those were available. And so we still had to figure out how to be able to still support people who were looking to get into recovery or stay in recovery, because now that was going to be a challenge. And so we spent a couple of months just coming together as a team and figuring out what that's going to look like, and to look back on our own organizational history and see what we've done before. We've done day programs before. Okay. So maybe we could look at doing that. And so in September, early September, we opened up to a virtual program, which is virtually unheard of in the treatment world, certainly in Indigenous addiction treatment services. But that was really the, when you think about services and what's safe and risk levels, that was still providing service, still keeping people safe, keeping them in their homes, not getting people in person together. So that was, in terms of risk level, it was the lower risk of many options. And so we started offering things online on Zoom. And we had donations of tablets if we needed to lend them out. We got equipment at work to be able to be able to offer that because we didn't actually have.
Well, I was just going to say, like, good on you guys, because I mean that's obviously something that during this pandemic, like, I know that, you know, from seeing all the statistics, like, there was such an uptick in the need for mental health services. So I can imagine that, especially in communities that might not be as accessible, having that would be even more of an importance.
Yeah, exactly. Because for many people, we're the go-to people when it comes to addiction services. And then there's another agency or organization that specifically focuses on mental wellness. So both of us had a rise in requests and clients who needed our support.
Yeah, I kind of want to double click in on, you know, saying that you guys are the go-to services, because I'm just kind of curious of, like, what services exist outside of for those rural communities, like, what really was the options for them if a center like yours isn't available?
So what's available when the treatment center in your community is closed? And that has been probably one of the biggest struggles, because there's so little available. And then because the provincial addiction services or provincial treatment centers, they were at half capacity because they couldn't have clients share rooms. So typically in a treatment center like ours, for example, we have 10 beds, but there are 5 bedrooms. So they're two clients per bedroom. And the provincial treatment centers, as far as I know, were only able to have half the number of clients because they could only have one client per bedroom. They eventually figured out like once the client has been there for 2 weeks, then they can start sharing rooms, that kind of stuff. But for quite a long time. So not only would they have had a waiting list, but now they can't even get through their waiting list at the rate that they normally would, because they're only able to care for half the number of clients that they normally do. So, and then our treatment center had been closed for several months. And that's partly contributing to people not having someone to reach out to. And many counselors and other medical professionals weren't seeing people in person, just over Zoom. And so it has been a huge challenge for people trying to access medical care, including mental health care.
How does it look different? You know, the work that you guys are doing, obviously, community plays such a significant role in Indigenous communities. So I'm kind of curious, like, community nursing, the approach to that, what does that look like? I would just kind of love to learn a little bit more about community nursing.
Yeah. So community nursing, in my experience, I mean, you can have medical clinics within communities. And so you can have nurses working in a medical clinic where there's a doctor, nurse practitioner, other nurses, and you're doing the typical medical care. So they're coming in for an appointment. So there's that aspect to it. There's also the aspect of home care services, though that's delivered in community by community health nurses. So when you're discharged from the hospital and there's still some medical care that needs to be taken care of when you go home, you've got home care nurses that will go to your home and maybe it's changing a dressing, or maybe it's taking care of some other kind of wound or medical issue, or checking in, making sure that you're doing okay. There's home care services. And then there's the public health component to community health nursing, which we've kind of, I think, got a glimpse of through the pandemic in terms of what is public health and what do we do. So in public health, that's about it could be immunization clinics. I did that for several years. So typically we were immunizing children. Obviously this past year it was focusing on getting people their COVID vaccine.
Of course.
It can also be about communicable disease in general. So when there's outbreaks of other kinds of viruses and illnesses, public health are the ones that do contact tracing, contact people, let them know they were exposed, and all of those components that go with it. For me, I've done a lot of the maternal and child health aspects. So doing prenatal classes, doing prenatal care, doing home visits with new families or expectant families. And then once the baby's born, checking in on the families once they get back home. And also developing programs in community. So I've been part of developing a program that that helps to connect the most vulnerable and underserved community members and better connect them to services that they need. So it might be folks that are living in domestic violence or living with substance abuse,
right,
and getting them better connected to services that can help them.
Mm-hmm. A bit of a change in direction of this question particularly. I know that, speaking from experience, somebody who works within the mental health space, and you talk to a lot of people, or I talk to a lot of people, I listen to their stories, and sometimes that can be really tough. And so I kind of wanted to know, like, with everything that we've seen recently, with, you know, whether it's residential schools or just on the communities as a whole, the trauma that I'm sure that you are exposed to, I mean, how do you stay mentally engaged and mentally healthy in all of this? Because as somebody who's providing support, I mean, how are you getting support yourself?
Wow, that's a that's a great question. We don't often ask the healthcare providers how they are. Because we're so we're so consumed as healthcare providers, especially in moments like this. I think it can consume us. We want to be able to help as many people as we can, especially when we know that even before the pandemic, our communities and many community members were struggling with. For us, we see the addictions part of things, mental health, and I think the residential schools and the uncovering of previously undiscovered, unmarked graves, as brought residential schools and the stories and those histories back into the news. And I think it's given a bit more context for more people around why our communities have so many people that are living with a mental illness, or living with addictions, and where that comes from. Because I think that even before the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, before 2015, I don't think many Canadians knew that story and that history and really didn't understand the context of those mental illnesses and mental health issues and addictions.
Yeah.
And I think the narrative before that had always been something along the lines of we're Indigenous and we're somehow, therefore that makes us weak in some way. And that's why we're experiencing these things. And a lot of negative stereotypes connected to those things. And now with the TRC final report, which brought it into the news, and now with more news connected to residential schools with unmarked graves of children, I think that's really pulling at the heartstrings of the general public. And people are opening their hearts and minds even more to understanding where some of these issues are coming from. That they're not just they have nothing to do with the fact that we are Indigenous. It has everything to do with the historical context of colonization and forced assimilation, and that's the root cause of many of these issues that we're now having to help people get through.
Absolutely. And I think that, like, I mean, 1996, the last residential school was in Canada was officially closed. Like, that's 2 years before I was born, and I'm a 22-year-old kid. Like, to think that this trauma is old is just to turn a blind eye to history. I mean, this is recent trauma and generational. Like, to have a whole group of people, their entire existence, like, you know, to have that just tried to be consistently pulled away for years and ripped away for years and years and years, and then to live with that, it's just one of those things where it's like, how could you not experience the after effects of trauma?
Yes, and I think the general public had never made the connection between that trauma and the post-traumatic stress disorder that I would imagine many, many survivors are having to live with and have lived with without being diagnosed. And that because we can label or give it a label, I suppose, it makes it, people seem to be able to connect with that easier. So, for example, when we talk about veterans who have gone away to war or first responders, we don't question the mental health challenges that they many of them can experience when they come back from war or after being a first responder to a very traumatic event or scene. We never question that. And and the general public and the general narrative is, of course, they need mental health support and help. But the general public has never made that connection with residential school survivors. Mm-hmm. And instead has stigmatized them. And I think that that's starting to change and shift slowly, but in a better direction, in a direction where they have a bigger heart and understand that, of course, residential school survivors need help and support after experiencing horrific, horrific events on a daily basis as a child. Yeah. Yeah. And then we now need to also consider that when those children grew up, they became parents themselves. And we can only ever expect someone to parent based on the parenting that they had as a child. So residential school survivors had what kind of parenting? So of course they repeated many of those abuses as parents because that's all they knew. Yeah. That's how they knew how to love and interact with people. And so that's how you get intergenerational, or one way you get intergenerational trauma. And so to break that cycle, as someone who runs a rehab center, it is absolutely a hard task to break those cycles of violence and substance 100%. Use.
I've seen through interviewing people with complex post-traumatic stress disorder and PTSD that the ripple effects that exist after that trauma, I think so many people are blind to the fact that, you know, they've lived cushy, comfortable lives and they see somebody go through a traumatic event and they think it's a traumatic event. That event traumatized you, but the only trauma you experience is surrounding that exact event. And the web that it creates and the trauma and the people you interact with, the people that you're around, how that trauma spreads, it's the idea of intergenerational, but also just community spread of trauma itself. It's it's systematic.
And the part of our challenge is that certainly in a pandemic, or any other time, quite frankly, but what happens when those community members reach out to mental health clinicians and professionals for help and support? Very rarely will you be able to find someone that understands the history and context and challenges related to that. And so the cultural safety within the world of mental health services, that's our challenge right now, is to get people, professionals, culturally safe.
Yeah. How do you go about bettering that? I know that that's obviously a fairly broad question, but I mean that seems like obviously that would be hugely important and an emphasis should be put on something like that.
Yeah. So you need people or organizations and companies who can do that kind of training. You also need people willing to listen and hear what has to be said. And when you're asking professionals who have been doing this work for a long time to change the way they do work, I know as a nurse, I've been a nurse for 18 years, you can't just go to a conference, attend a conference on cultural safety, and then return home and expect that anything will be different in their practice. It is a daily change in the way that you think and relate to specific clients with these kinds of traumas and histories. So it's ongoing work. It's happening. It needs to happen in every profession. We see that in the calls to action in the TRC. It specifically calls out medical schools and nursing schools specifically, but that really is about the whole entire health system. And we also need to be able to have our own people go and become these professionals. And that's a whole... Right. It will come. I think in 20 years, we'll see some big changes and more youth that do become the healthcare professionals. But we're just beginning this. We're just at the beginning of some of these conversations. And we've been saying this for decades, that these things need to be different, certainly within the healthcare system. But the TRC, I say this over and over again, the TRC, the final report, the media attention that it got has created a critical mass within the general population that all of a sudden we can, and it feels like night and day, we can have these conversations with people like yourself and others who really want to hear what we have to say now. We wouldn't be having this conversation, Kyle, probably in 10 years ago. I can tell you what it was like to teach nursing 7 years ago, before the TRC. And it was really hard to reach students because they felt that, why do I need to learn about Indigenous health when I'm never going to work with people who are Indigenous? Because in their mind, you only work with Indigenous people when you're in an Indigenous community, which doesn't even make any sense. I said, if you're if you guys are going to work in Moncton, because I was teaching at the satellite site in Moncton, if you guys are going, or even Fredericton, to be frank, if you're going to work in any of the four cities here in New Brunswick, you're going to come across Indigenous people. How could you not? And you need to learn how to be better nurses for them. And but it wasn't until the TRC that conversations took a complete 180. And all of a sudden, I was being asked to do guest lectures left, right, and center and be part of this committee and that committee. And what do you think? And what do you think? And what do you think? So it's just really been a whirlwind of change. And we really have to make sure this momentum doesn't stop and that it continues. And we keep pushing that flywheel so that we can keep building that momentum, because we're moving in the right direction, but we can't stop.
No, absolutely. No, I think that just like we've seen over the course of these past couple of years with different social movements, like one of the biggest things is keep your foot on the gas. Like you can't let up for a second. I was really shocked when you said you think that we'll see a change in about 20 years from now. And I kind of, like, as I was shocked, I kind of tried to think about why that shocked me so much. And I kind of thought about, again, that generational trauma. You said yourself on a phone call that we had previously that, you know, as early as your grandparents, your parents' age, they had to basically renounce their Indigenous heritage if they wanted to go to school. So that, again, ripple effect, I'm sure is still felt.
It's felt because those of us where that rule doesn't exist anymore, so we're not enfranchised, we're not forced to give up our Indigenous status, according to the government, when we go to school anymore. But that was certainly the reality in my grandparents' time. And for some people, those elders are still around, those parents are still around. So they remember what it was like to not be given that, be able to. I mean, it's not really a choice. Do you give up your ethnicity? Do you give up being able to feel like you can identify as Indigenous? Or do you go to school? To be given that, to be presented with that, it doesn't really feel like a choice. So for those of us now for whom that rule or those rules don't apply to anyone anymore, for me to be able to go to university and get a degree, I actually have two bachelor's degree and a master's degree. I take a lot of pride in that, not for myself, but for my family and for my community. Mm. And I know that when I got my first degree, it's in kinesiology of all things. when I got my first degree, my community is quite small. It's Bear River First Nation. So we don't have a lot of elders, but there was an elder there who, at the end of the school year in June, they always acknowledge all the high school graduates and there aren't many university graduates to be able to acknowledge and honor. And she gave me, I still remember this and I still have it, she gave me a baby eagle feather. Not to suggest that the accomplishment isn't big, but she knew that it was just the beginning of something much bigger and was a way to encourage me to keep going. Wonderful. And that it meant a lot to the community to have another graduate because they were so rare. And so, and for when I think about my family and that side of my family, I believe of the many cousins that I have, I believe I was only the second one, if I'm not mistaken, to even have a bachelor's degree.
Wow. I wanted to kind of talk briefly here about stigma, because when we were talking about the idea of elders having to renounce their literal heritage, literally who they are. You know, for me, I'm looking at that from a mental health and a stigma standpoint, and I'm looking at that as an educated Indigenous person isn't an Indigenous person. That's the public perception. It's if you are uneducated, if you do not go to college, university, you are Indigenous. But as soon as you get that level of education, like you can't, and obviously that's so detrimental. That's horrendous to think of, like, and obviously, you know, thinking of like grandparents who saw, like my grandparents or the grandparents of my peers, who would have kind of like grown up with that stigma, like in that stigma, Like, that's just, it's just so terrible to think that that warped public perception so much.
Yeah. And I think the general public also forgets who benefits from continuing that narrative and continuing to pass that narrative on, who benefits from saying that one group of people based on their ethnicity alone are somehow lesser qualified, lesser people than another group. And that's part of colonization, is to suggest that other people aren't as good as us.
Right. Yeah. If you, you know, had a few minutes to kind of talk about just like some absolute stigma breakers that you want to continue to push within your work, what kind of, what does that look like? What are those things that are priorities for you to change perception?
That we're good enough. That we're good enough to be seen as Canadians. For our people to be able to go to a local hospital in New Brunswick and be treated properly is still a struggle. It's still a struggle even today. We, for anyone that heard about Rodney Levi's case last June, knows what I'm talking about. There was, Horizon had a board member who came out publicly to suggest that people who are living with an addiction, that that's somehow self-inflicted and that somehow they're less deserving of care. That is horrible. That's horrible thinking at a board of director level. So how do you think that trickles down to the emergency room? Of course it does. So we're still struggling in 2021 with racism in the healthcare system. I could go on with many more stories that are very recent, and we're still experiencing these things in 2021. Yeah.
2021, eh? After a year, like the past couple of years being as socially aware as I think a lot of people would like to think they have been, that that's still, that systematic, you know, racism in your own backyard. I think I will personally say from my own standpoint that when I saw everything going on with the Black Lives Matter movement down in the States, and it coming up to Canada as well, initially there was this thought of, but I'm Canadian, you know, there's not that level of racism here in Canada. And then you start to, you know, living in a sheltered white town here down in southern New Brunswick. And it was funny, as like after I went to Toronto is when I kind of realized, like, you know, coming, being in Toronto and then coming back home, I was like, yeah, you know, these things exist in like these big cities, but it's not as bad. You know, it's not as bad as the States. It's not as bad as here. But this is like, this is New Brunswick. This is our own backyard.
Yep.
And so I wanted to know, like, what type of stuff can people, such as myself, people who haven't been necessarily exposed to the story, these histories, you know, because of obviously just never being taught in public school, never really being chatted, like having this kind of stuff be talked about publicly and openly. Like, what kind of stuff can I do to better be an ally to the change that you would like to see within your communities?
So the first thing that I always recommend to people is whenever you get a chance to attend or to host a Kairos blanket exercise.
Okay.
Is that something that's familiar to you?
No, not at all.
No? Okay. So Kairos Canada is a social justice organization, and one of their branches is Indigenous rights. And they, back in the 90s, as a response to RCAP, the Royal Commission on Aboriginal People, they created what's called the blanket exercise. And it's, of course, evolved over time, but it's an exercise in which the participants are walked through the history of this land, the 500 plus years, in about an hour, hour and 15 minutes. And blankets, it's called the blanket exercise because the facilitators lay out when you can do it in person, they lay out the blankets on the floor. Their edges are touching. Each blanket represents an Indigenous nation on Turtle Island. So Turtle Island is also North America. But the blanket exercise in Canada focuses on Canada specifically and its history. And there are two facilitators who basically read a script. One reads as the narrator. And so it's sharing the history from an Indigenous perspective. We're very used to reading and being taught history from a settler's perspective, a European settler's perspective. Mm-hmm. And so they read back and forth. The other person reads the European role or the settler, European settler role. And so you walk through the history, blankets get folded up, reduced in size, people who move around. And without a doubt, every single time that it's that I facilitated, people, I think, have many aha moments. It opens their eyes. It shares with them a perspective that they had never been encouraged to consider before. And it's usually, I know the history of Canada, but I had never thought about it from that perspective.
Absolutely.
So what does it mean to have European settlers want to come over to Canada to get land? Well, it means that Indigenous communities were moved by force, were forced to have to move to parts of the land that they were unfamiliar with, that were not good places for resource. So, for example, if they were moved in, for us, if they were moved to the woodlands, well, it means that we don't have access to the water anymore, and we need that in the summertime.
Right.
Or if we're moved away from certain areas where the moose don't go there, how are we going to feed our families in the wintertime? And so we're not encouraged in history class, or at least I wasn't, to think about what it means for new settlers to come over, and they were given prime land. So it's no accident that Moncton is where it is, St. John is where it is, Fredericton is where it is. They're very strategic locations. And it meant that the Indigenous people whose land that is, currently is, we've never given up our land in any treaty. And so it's unsurrendered, unceded territory here in New Brunswick, in Mi'kma'ki. And so the chiefs continue to assert that those treaties, ours are peace and friendship treaties. All they say, all they boil down to is, we agreed to live in peace and harmony together. It has nothing to do with land surrender. And so when there's resource development, we're never consulted, and yet this is our territory.
It's terrible. Jeez. Are you guys planning on hosting one of these ceremonies anytime soon? Because it would honestly just be an honor to be there.
So it's not a ceremony, it's an exercise. So I just want to separate those two words.
Okay. Yep, absolutely.
So anyone can request a booking through Kairos Canada. So Kairos is K-A-I-R-O-S. Kairos Canada, just look up blanket exercise. It'll be the first thing that shows up on a Google search. And so you can request one in person, or you can request a, they now have, I work for Kairos part-time, so I'll say we also have a virtual version of the blanket exercise that is just as effective and powerful as the in-person one. And so anyone can request to book. Usually you're booking on behalf of a group. So if you could find a group to do it with, that would be great, but we can connect offline.
I'm sure I could probably drum some people up for sure.
And so that would be the first thing that I would recommend to anyone who's looking to be part of the solution and not continue to be part of the problem, is attend a blanket exercise, because it really is a great foundation for conversations that happen afterwards and any work that you do. And as an ally, I think just be cautious. I'm going to share a cautionary note that sometimes people can get very overzealous about being an ally, and then it becomes about you and wanting to make sure that you as an ally are doing good things. And what happens is you guys get more credit for being an ally than those of us who have been doing the same work. But because we're Indigenous, working for advocating for Indigenous people, it sort of becomes understood that somehow that's part of what we're supposed to do, and we never get the credit for moving the needle on some of these things, but allies get more credit for their anti-racism work. So just be cautious about that. And most of the time, communities know, and Indigenous people know exactly what change we want to see. So be a megaphone for us, and not be the voice. Magnify our voice. And make sure that we're the ones that are sharing those ideas, thoughts, that we're the ones leading the work, and that you're in the background, not expecting to get credit or showcased for it, but in the background giving an extra set of hands to move this work and move the needle.
I'm so glad that you brought that up, because I feel like a lot of social, I just feel like it's very performative sometimes, you know, it is very much that, people want to, you know, it's almost, it's as weird of a word as to say, it's almost trendy. And so I really appreciate you making that note as well. Mm. That's amazing. The last couple questions I have, first of all, is how can people just support your clinic and the work that you guys are doing right now?
I'm pausing because I don't know that I've ever been asked that question. What can the general public do for the Rising Sun Treatment Center? I think just treat people the way they want to be treated. And so if you're saying something to someone that you wouldn't want someone to say to your mother or your sister or your family members, it probably isn't something you should be saying. And I think we get caught up in the idea of we should treat people the way we want to be treated, and that's centering your actions on you and not on them. And so ask people, you know, when I used to take nursing students to Elsie Buchdook for their clinical experience, every single time without fail, on the first day, the first visit, when I would introduce them to people at the health center, to elders in the community, I would take them to sacred spaces in the community. That's our first day. Without a doubt, they would always say, everyone's really nice. And they say it with that tone and that surprise in their voice.
Right.
Because they had always understood that we were scary people, that we were dangerous. I even had a student tell me once, my mother doesn't want me to come here because it's like the inner city. But I know it's not, so I'm coming anyway.
Wow.
And that just, it leaves me... it leaves me not surprised, but sad that people think of us as being scary, because, you know, on the media, we make the news when we're dead or being violent.
Yep.
And so, and in the movies, we're always seen as or portrayed as the perpetrators of violence. Cowboy and Indian movies always have the Indians perpetrating the violence when... Right. If you understand the history, it's very much the other way around.
Absolutely.
And when you're defending yourself, you shouldn't be seen as a perpetrator of violence. And so when students come to, they always say, you guys are really nice. And I said, you sound surprised by that. And they talk about how they had the only stories they had ever heard. And I said, you know, there's danger in the single story. There's a TED talk about the dangers of the single story. Yeah. And so we don't have enough media attention around all of the kinds of Indigenous people that there are. But we have lots and lots of stories about all the different kinds of Canadians there are. And so we have different stories about what a Canadian is. But we need more stories about what Indigenous people are. And so the students are always very excited to know who we are, because they're learning who we are from us directly, from the source.
Absolutely.
And so we spend time with people, and they're always very appreciative of people's time. And they're always surprised at how much we're willing to share our community and our culture. And I always remind students before they go, there isn't a glass door and there is no gate that will keep you from going into a community. It's just in your mind. We're always wanting to share. For anyone that knows the history of the Acadians arriving on the shores of Annapolis Royal in 1604, knows that we didn't turn them away. My community is right there. We didn't turn them away. We welcomed them onto our territory, made sure that they were safe and that they could live on this land. And we lived in harmony together for quite a while. And in New Brunswick, we have gotten far, far away from that original relationship. And we have a long way to go before we can say that we're back at that state of being with each other. So in New Brunswick, I always, when I do a blanket exercise, when I facilitate, I always challenge people. I said, can you tell me where there's a Mi'kmaq flag because most of the time when I do blanket exercise, I'm on Mi'kmaq territory, and challenge them to find a flag outside of an indigenous community flying in New Brunswick.
Right.
And then I say, can you find an Acadian flag anywhere in New Brunswick? They're all over the place.
Yeah.
And I'm not suggesting they shouldn't be, but what I am suggesting is that wherever there's an Acadian flag, there absolutely has to be a Mi'kmaq flag flying with it and before it. The order of those flags, the order of the flags that are outside town halls matter, right? You fly the Canadian flag in a specific location and it's a message. And I used to do the blanket exercise and in Moncton, and I would say, there are five flags flying outside Moncton City Hall. And I would tell them that it's the Canadian, the New Brunswick, the Acadian, the British flag, and the city of Moncton.
Wow.
There is no Mi'kmaq flag. There is an Acadian flag and a British flag and a Canadian flag.
Mm.
And so it was a group that I was doing this with that decided to push the city to fly the Mi'kmaq flag. And it's great that it's flying, except it's in the wrong position, in my opinion. But the fact that we have to push that we don't see those flags flying wherever there's a Canadian and New Brunswick flag, there absolutely has to be a Mi'kmaq flag. And wherever there's an Acadian flag, there needs to be a Mi'kmaq flag. There needs to be appreciation and understanding for why that flag is even here in New Brunswick in the first place.
Absolutely. Mm. Cheyenne, I really honestly, I can't thank you enough for just like taking the time and chatting with me today, because this has just been like it's been very, very eye-opening on my end. And and you know, just an amazing way, because I think that this is one of those things, like I came into this space hoping to learn, and I really feel like I did get a new appreciation talking to you for the mental health and your communities and the work that has to be done. I just can't thank you enough. And I have one last question for you, if you have time.
Well, before you ask it, can I ask you what stood out the most? What's your biggest takeaway?
Yeah. Oh, 100%. Picking one is tough. The flag one was really interesting. Cause that's not even something I would have even thought about. In terms of the order of the flag and the what that says, having the flags in a certain order. Also, I mean, just talking about like having the students come in, because I'm assuming that these students are probably around my age, of that 19 to 23, 24 kind of thing. And so for them at my age, having that realization of Indigenous people aren't scary, these communities are welcoming and warm. And it's just for me, that really kind of stood out, because I'm like, that's me. Like I'm that same 22-year-old who grew up only learning about, like, you know, opening up a history book and seeing, you know, white people in Egypt, like, you know, when we're learning about the Egyptians, like all that kind of stuff. Like it really kind of showed me like how much I've grown up in a culture that I didn't even realize I was growing up in. And just kind of like how much I would like to have an experience like that, where I could come and visit these communities and really just kind of like, and just see the truth in these communities instead of just like what I've been told, to develop an ideal for myself.
Great. Thanks for sharing that, Kyle.
Of course. Yeah. The last question that I have for you is, at the end of every episode, I like to give out a challenge to my listeners, something that they can implement into their day, their week, their month, whatever it may be, just to kind of like live a happier, healthier life. But this one I want to kind of like skew a little bit differently, because I feel like we've kind of already talked about it. I would love for you to kind of give a challenge to my listeners to educate themselves further on what we talked about today.
And yeah, so take time to educate themselves, be conscious about the source of the information. I'll just highlight a story for you that illustrates that.
Please.
For those that were here in New Brunswick in 2014, there was a lot of disruption related to shale gas exploration. On October 17th, 2014 was when things got quite more violent. Mm-hmm. And the police showed up. There were barricades, those kinds of things. Police showed up in riot gear. There were police cars on fire. It was a big news story, especially for New Brunswick. And I was very conscious about watching the 6 o'clock news and the different stations that were here and who showcased that on October 17th at 6 o'clock.
Right.
Global News did, CBC did, but not CTV. It took CTV an entire week before they mentioned it on their news station. A week after it all disrupted, a week after police cars are on fire, there's riot, RCMP showing up in riot gear, and you wait a week to put that on your news?
Yeah.
That tells me a lot about the relationship between that station and different unspoken partners in that incident. So, meaning the connection between Irving and the news station.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So be aware that those mainstream sources may not be the best sources of information about Indigenous people. So be aware of APTN News, Aboriginal People's Television News. That's a source. You're going to see all kinds of stories there of, sure, there's going to be difficult and negative stories that get shared, but there's also so many positive stories that they share about what's happening in community.
Right.
And just be aware of what social media pages that people like, what's their go-to when they want to find out what's happening in community. Make sure that it's an Indigenous source and not a mainstream source. So that's the other part of the challenge is go educate yourself, but be aware of who the source is. Make sure that it's, if it's a book that you're reading, that it's an Indigenous author, for example. That's amazing.
Yeah. No, honestly, Cheyenne, like, again, I really can't thank you enough for just taking the time today and talking to me and my audience. And I absolutely would love to have you back at some point to continue the conversation.
Yeah, you know how to reach me.
Absolutely. Perfect, Cheyenne. Well, thank you so much.
Thanks, Kyle.
And that is how you close out a season.
That, yeah. No, absolutely, man. I want to ask you the same question that Cheyenne asked me, because this is kind of like your thing. What stands out to you the most about that conversation?
I'm glad you asked. I love how this episode felt.
How it felt?
Yeah, don't make it weird. Like, what I'm saying is, like, whatever. We're a mental health podcast, and like it says in the description of the show, mental health is, it's in everything that we do. It's not just mental illness. It's how we interact with one another and everything like that. Cheyenne could have explained like the whole therapy process and went into detail about services provided by her treatment center and trauma recovery and addiction recovery and the nuances of her job. But instead, she shared her story.
Mm.
You know, she talked about her community and her experiences. And even though it's not directly talking about mental health itself, it is. You know, when you look at the story through the empathetic lens of mental health, you see the trauma and how it plays a role in everyday life for a major segment of the Indigenous community. She shared herself with our audience, and that is special. So,
yeah, I'm really excited to continue to, like, tell these stories.
Yeah, me too.
Just the beginning, my friend.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much to Cheyenne for taking the time today. We'd love to have her back on the show down the road. We'll be back for next season of Life's Rec on September 10th. So that's a month from now, which I know. I'm going to miss you guys too. It's a long time, but, you know, with everything that we've got coming up, we kind of need some time. And I will say, because you guys, you know, have waited till the end of this episode, and you could have heard this if you had to listen to our Wednesday's A Rec this week, which was a Thursday's A Rec, but whatever, because that's where you get the most up-to-date news on everything Life's A Rec. But we're going to be kicking off next season on September 10th with a housemate from Big Brother Canada Season 9. I'm not going to say who it is.
Got some big things coming, baby.
We love you guys so much. And you guys can stay in touch through Instagram. And just remember that through all of it, the ups and downs, the happy days, the sad days, life's a wreck. And we'll see you in a month.
shoot. Life's a wreck.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.